The title for tonight is It's My Right, Understanding Natural Rights and the Purpose of Politics. And I think in a certain way you can sum up, when we're talking about rights, which is something that we talk about almost everywhere in our culture, you know, it's constantly coming up, and certainly it's all over the place in the law, but it's all over the place in our political conversations. It's all over the place even on university campuses. And if we were to take just a very average, contemporary, popular understanding of rights, you might be able to sum it up with the phrase, it's my right. Like, it's my right, therefore I want it, or I deserve it, I'm owed it. That is, people in our culture are very quick to perceive first what they're entitled to, or what they think is their due, somehow, and to perceive an injustice as a violation of their rights. And increasingly, when they perceive this, they seek some remedy, they seek some redress. And that's only understandable because in our contemporary understanding, if you have a right, you must be able to enforce it. That means to get other people to respect it, and even to use the law, or to use some other administrative remedy that has a kind of bite to accomplish that. And the courts in our system increasingly recognize and provide remedies for even new formulations of rights, and sometimes we might even say new rights altogether. So just a little personal background here. I worked for a number of years at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., as a trial attorney in what was called the Bivens section, which is the, I don't know if we have any lawyers here. One. Okay, so maybe I won't put you on the spot because it's kind of an obscure corner of the law. But it's the name comes from a Supreme Court decision. Bivens was the first party in the Supreme Court's case. And basically, it was a case that arose where the Supreme Court said, if you feel like your constitutional rights have been violated by a federal official, you can sue the federal official for money in order to compensate you for the deprivation of your constitutional rights, like your right to free speech or your Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure or something like that. So this was basically creating at least a new legal remedy to enforce certain violations of constitutional rights. And so the Department of Justice had to create a new office to handle those kinds of cases, and that's the office I worked in. So I represented federal officials when we thought that they had not acted improperly, of course. We would always do an investigation. Actually, it was one of the nice parts about that job was that unlike a lot of other legal positions where you pretty much have to take your clients as you find them, in this job, we always did an investigation to decide if we were going to represent the client. Because the United States is not in the business of defending unconstitutional conduct. If the DOJ decides that this is unconstitutional conduct, we don't want to defend it. We want to prosecute it, actually. So that was a nice part about that job, is that you always kind of felt like you were on the right side of things. But it meant that I dealt a lot with claims about rights and had to think about the ways that they are good and important to vindicate in the legal system, and also the ways that they can be abused. So you can think about constitutional rights, but there are all kinds of other rights too. We could talk about contractual rights. If you sign a lease with your landlord, you have rights that the law will recognize and enforce to occupy that apartment, for example. Or there would be other kinds of rights, like rights under international treaties. That's not from the Constitution, but from some other source, like, for example, the Geneva Convention on how prisoners of war are to be treated, or the UN Declaration of Human Rights. That's a more general declaration that was enacted after the Second World War and that drew on a kind of natural law or natural rights tradition. Okay, so a little historical background. In the standard history of what we call natural rights, these are rights that don't claim to come from some kind of positive enactment. So if the Congress says that you have a right to, I don't know, healthcare in a particular form, that would be a positive right enacted by the positive law. It didn't exist before Congress passed the law, and after the Congress passed the law, it gave you the right under the law to make this claim. We could say constitutional rights sometimes look like this. The reason you have the right is that the Constitution, which is a kind of fundamental positive law, but still a form of positive law, enacted that right. But this can be a little confusing because sometimes those constitutional rights are recognizing what in American political discourse we would generally say are natural rights, that is, rights that belong to everyone by virtue of the fact that you are a human person. Now, this is not making an appeal to someone who has decided to legislate this, even on the level of a fundamental constitution. It's a claim, it's a deeper and bigger claim, that there is a foundation somehow in reality that gives you a certain right to something. So, there's a lot of political philosophy and political theory that goes into trying to articulate what are those rights and where do they come from. And in the standard history that you would typically encounter in talking about these natural rights, they're generally thought to have been a prominent feature of what we might call the Enlightenment period's political philosophy. So you might think of thinkers like John Locke or Thomas Hobbes, who were great Enlightenment political theorists and who developed theories of natural law and natural rights. And certainly they were influential, John Locke in particular, influential in our own American founding. So a lot of the American founders read John Locke. But what about bringing this up to our own time? In our own epoch, we've seen some serious challenges arise. The proliferation of new rights, or claims to new rights, some of which now seem to be rather clearly incompatible with each other, and claims that become ever more shrill for rights. And the difficulty is that as these rights claims become to occupy more and more space in our political life, there's less room for making prudential judgments, because it seems that if someone has a right, it's like an absolute claim there that's taking up all the space, sucking the oxygen out of the political discourse, as it were, because all of the questions are already decided. And certainly if we think that the Supreme Court or the courts in general have as their one of their principal tasks to like enforce these rights, it turns politics more and more into a form of litigation and moves it from deliberative bodies or representative bodies into the courts. I think that's a problem that people have been increasingly perceiving in our time. And some of these rights are plainly incompatible. You might think, even if we just tried to frame it in very neutral legal terms, you might think of the claim that there's a right to an abortion and the claim that there is a right to life. Now, obviously, in the case when we're talking about if there is a right to life of an unborn person or an unborn human fetus, then we have a conflict of rights. How do you adjudicate that? And it's increasingly common that we find ourselves confronted with these conflicting rights claims. There are some, and this is kind of the background to this talk in a way, one of the reasons why I started reflecting on this more recently. There are some, especially you might say more conservative thinkers or even some conservative Christian thinkers, who identify a particular problem in our contemporary discourse precisely on this point. How many of you have read the Benedict Option or heard of it, at least some of you? Okay, so the Benedict Option, a book written by Rod Dreher, which has been much more popularly discussed. I think there are a lot of people who kind of know something about the Benedict Option, even if they haven't read the book. I don't want to get into the Benedict Option tonight. That's not the point of this talk. But the starting point of this book, which has been rather popular, is to identify precisely the proliferation of rights and rights that are perhaps incompatible with the Christian tradition as seeing this as a kind of like serious crisis. And so Rod Dreher says, well, in view of this, we have to recognize that like politics is not going to solve our problems. And we need to find some other way to do it. And what he proposes is not what I'm proposing, but just that that's the kind of background. Coming out of that view is the view of some who wonder whether the experience that we're now having of increasingly shrill and proliferating claims of rights, incompatible rights, rights that are sucking the political oxygen out of our system, whether that tells us that, in fact, the whole project, based on the Enlightenment ideas, and some would say that are at the center of the American founding, this whole project was doomed to failure from the start. And as soon as you try to create a political system that is basically grounded in according these kind of absolute rights to people, you're going to end up with a system that breaks down. Now, that would be very worrying if you are, like me, wanting to be a good American. And, I mean, I grew up venerating and loving the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and I took an oath to uphold and defend them when I became an officer of the law, as it were, at the Department of Justice. So, this is kind of the question that I wanted to begin with. Can we make sense of the American project in view of these rights, and how to understand what rights are? Do they inevitably lead to this kind of self-contradiction or a collapsing regime? I want to argue, actually, that the situation is not so dire. So if you're feeling like, oh, gosh, Father, you have really, like, laid a heavy burden on us. The room is, like, depressed now. You know, Chick-fil-A, it seemed like things were going well. So I want to argue that the tradition of natural rights actually has very deep roots, roots that are deeper than the Enlightenment, in the thought of a great medieval tradition, and even going back much further than that, and that the great medieval philosopher and theologian St. Thomas Aquinas and his subsequent interpreters have a way to understand well the question of rights and how they fit into a well-functioning political system. So the hero of this talk is a Dominican. Surprise, surprise. St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, if you don't know, was a 13th century Dominican and philosopher, theologian, one of the great figures in the history of the Western intellectual tradition, and the particular heritage of the Dominican order. Okay, so I think you find a workable and in fact, even powerful synthesis in Aquinas, and it's not very well known. In fact, I would say it's almost totally unknown, even by people who study Aquinas on politics and law. And it needs to be better known, because I think this is where you find the at least the initial indications of where the solution is going to be. Okay, so that's what I want to lay out for you today. And I think you have to begin with how Aquinas understands the relationship between some key concepts. Justice, law, in Latin, lex, that's the language Aquinas wrote in, and right, or rights, and the common good. Okay, so let's start with justice. In the Summa Theologiae, or the Summa Theologica, that's the great synthetic work of Aquinas, he first discusses justice as an attribute of God. That's where he starts. Always a good thing to do. Start with God. And in doing this, Aquinas affirms a key principle. Justice always refers to a wise or reasoned ordering among things. So if you ask, how is God just? Where is justice in God? Aquinas says, when we speak about justice in God, we are referring, first of all, to God's intellect, the divine mind. Insofar as God's mind conceives the perfectly wise plan by which everything is ordered back to God. And justice is then secondarily in God's will, insofar as he acts according to the wise order he has conceived. So this is a capital point. It might seem to you right now like this is kind of irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. This is like very important. Aquinas' view is very different from later theories about justice and law and God's place in it, which could be called voluntaristic theories because they emphasize the voluntas. That's Latin for the will. They emphasize the will. Think of voluntary, right? Voluntary is something you do by will. Voluntaristic theories say that justice resides principally in God's will. And they would say, since God wills it, you're bound to obey it, and that is the ultimate root of justice. Just obey whatever God wills. Aquinas doesn't have that theory. For Aquinas, law is not primarily an expression of God's will. Rather, the wisely ordered plan of creation in God's intellect, in his mind, is like the law. Aquinas calls it a law that guides the perfectly just willing of God, which means that law is an expression of reason, an ordering according to reason, even in God. So does God obey the law? It's kind of a silly question if you are a voluntaristic theorist, because God's will is the law. I mean, God, how can he? For Aquinas, you can actually say that God obeys the law. In what sense? God conceives the order, and then he acts according to it. Of course, it would be impossible for him to do otherwise. But his will actually does do what his intellect conceives. And in that sense, he obeys this ordering that he has in his mind. Now, we have to add all kinds of additional qualifications. God is eternal. He has only one perfect conception of all things. Okay, you might be thinking, I did not sign up for this, Father. Chick-fil-A was a good start. I saw the poster. It didn't say anything about it. Okay, we're moving closer to the solution. Okay, this understanding of justice, order, and reason shows up again in Aquinas' definition of law. So we've talked a little bit about justice, now law. This is the famous definition that Aquinas gives. An ordination of reason for the common good made by one with authority and promulgated. Okay, so Aquinas crafted this definition with care, intending it to account not only for written human laws, like acts of Congress, but also other forms of law, like natural law, divine positive law, and the eternal law in the mind of God. That's this law that is the order of the whole cosmos. Like justice, law for Aquinas designates an order of reason, and it's a rule and measure of acts, not primarily because you're bound to obey it, but because the law sets forth an ordered plan to attain the end, which is the good. So that the end of the whole creation is God. And the end of the political community is the common good. We have laws in order to direct our lives towards, as a community, towards the good of the community. So Aquinas treats human justice as a part of a broader account about how man is ultimately ordered to God within the complex network of overlapping relationships he has with others, like family, neighbors, the city, and so forth. So this is a key dimension of justice for Aquinas. It implies a reasoned or wise ordering, an ordering to the good, and an ordering that makes man good. Okay, so in fact, there are three elements then to Aquinas' account of justice. One, it's an ordering. Two, according to reason. And three, to the good. Okay, so with that introduction to Aquinas on law and justice, now let's talk about the key term for an understanding of Aquinas on rights, and that is the Latin word that will later be translated as rights. In Latin, it's ius. So that's I-U-S. Ius. Sometimes you see it spelled J-U-S, but it's the same word in Latin. So Aquinas says, and I'm going to use the Latin word just for a minute because it's helpful to not jump too quickly to our modern understanding of rights. So by using this word, we're able to maybe understand a little bit better what Aquinas is talking about. He says that ius is the object of justice. So one is just, you are just, when you render to another his ius. So what does that mean? Now it's hard to translate into English. You can translate it as right, but it can also mean the just thing or what is due. So we can say that the ius is what is right or even the fair. Okay, so this is a concept that it's a richer concept in Aquinas' Latin than it is in our English, because our English will end up kind of determining it to one shade of meaning. Aquinas' point by saying this, though, that the ius is the object of justice, is that we judge whether an action is just or whether a law is just by reference to this objective measure of justice. Have I given to the other his ius? That is, what is fair or what is due. So this has an objective character. In other words, it doesn't depend so much on the individual characteristics of the person I'm dealing with. It's out there in a way that doesn't just depend on who it is that I'm dealing with. Does that make sense? Like, if I buy a plate of Chick-fil-A from you, there's a kind of objective measure. It doesn't matter who you are. There's a kind of objective measure of what I owe you in order for you to give me that plate of delicious, you know, delicious chicken. All right, so even so, now most what I've told you so far, this is kind of the standard account of Aquinas on justice. And if you read an encyclopedia article on it or something, you'd get basically this. Most people stop there. Okay, I don't want to stop there. Why? Because that might lead you to think that ius for Aquinas can't really be translated into rights that you possess in a kind of way. But in fact, it's entirely possible, and Aquinas does speak about this objective fairness or what is due from the perspective of the person to whom it is owed, suggesting that that person can make a claim for what is due. And actually, this is very easy for us to see. We do it all the time. The person has a right to it. And that's another meaning of the word ius. So it's simply to regard the objective measure of what is just in this transaction, what is just in this law, and you regard it from the perspective of the person who is making a claim about it. And if you read widely in Aquinas, you'll find him very explicitly speaking of this in the sense that you can individually make a claim in justice for what is due to you. So, now, I make that point just because that's hotly debated, or I would say there aren't even very many people who recognize that in Aquinas. But if you wanted, I could give you, you know, like 23 different places where Aquinas talks about that. But I'm going to presume that's less interesting to you, so I'm just going to move on. But it is a very important point that actually Aquinas did have this kind of theory, and most people don't think he did. But it's already there in Aquinas. All right, so we can skip a few pages. Now this, what I've just described to you, is precisely how some later Dominican Thomists, I told you Dominicans are going to be the heroes here, right? How later Dominican Thomists thought through the controversies over the enslavement of the indigenous peoples of the New World. So, in the early 16th century, you had mostly Spanish, coming to a certain part of the New World, and the issue of slavery, or how the local peoples were being treated, became a very acute issue. It was perceived that this was very exploitative, and it was Dominican friars who were sent to these islands, like the Dominican Republic. There's a reason it's called the Dominican Republic. The capital city is named Santo Domingo. That's St. Dominic in Spanish, right? Okay, so they were sent to this part of the world as the priests for the colony, and they stood up and condemned this, and in fact told the colonists, the colonial masters, you are going to hell if you do not change what you are doing. And they refused Holy Communion to a bunch of them, actually. So, their names, Francisco de Vitoria, Domingo de Soto, Bartolome de las Casas. I don't know if these are names that you've heard before, but they deserve to be famous names. And in fact, Francisco de Vitoria is considered to be the father of international law, one of the great fathers. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's a statue of him outside the UN in New York. So, these later Dominicans had been formed in this idea of Aquinas, and they took it and began to apply it in the New World, saying that there were natural rights of the people who were being exploited or enslaved, and that there were therefore limits on what the king could do to those people. Now, that was very important because the king, you might think, is the one who gets to make the law. And they were saying, oh, no, 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 no. There are certain laws that you cannot make because it violates the order that God has created and the good that these individual human persons have in themselves. Now, there was a point where this understanding, especially in the Catholic Thomist tradition, got sort of lost in the mix. There was a shift starting in, say, the 16th and 17th centuries about how rights were conceived, how they were thought of in relation to law and justice. So for Aquinas, law, justice, and rights always belong to a larger order. A larger order, ultimately, you know, the order of people in a community, the order of the whole cosmos back to God. And that order is always directed in a certain way towards a good. So it's what a philosopher would call teleological. It has an end in view. But in later thinkers, like in the 17th century, you had some who began to define law principally in the voluntaristic way that I was mentioning before. Law understood as the will of the sovereign, whether of God or of the king. And therefore, law becomes simply an obligation imposed by a superior, that you have the duty to obey. In other words, law comes to be thought of as coming from the will of the superior, as a command, the lawgiver who hands down the rule, which means the law is no longer principally about reason, and therefore no longer principally about the order that is already there. It is instead about will and command. And this leads to an account of justice and rights that no longer see them as part of an overarching order, but as a kind of moral power of the individual over against the will of the commanding superior. Do you see the point? When you've made that shift in thinking about what is law, what is justice, what is the order, what is the good, what are rights, when you think that law is principally a matter of will, commanding obedience, then you need to create some zone of freedom to kind of counterbalance those commands. That, in my opinion, is where the nub of the issue is. In other words, the problem is not that we have appeals to rights. The problem is understanding, or a kind of impoverished understanding, of what law and justice are really all about. And we could talk about what is the historical source of those, of that shift in mentality, and there are different candidates you could propose. But the key changes seem to me to be two. One, that law is no longer thought of as an ordination of reason. And secondly, that rights don't have a reference to an overarching order of justice and the common good. And you put those together and you end up with a big problem, an unstable system. So, should we try to return to the purity, the original purity of the Thomistic synthesis? Can we formulate a Thomistic doctrine of rights that would be plausible today? Okay, so I'd like to answer that by summarizing the essentials of what I take to be Aquinas' position, and then talking a little bit about the purpose of politics from a classical perspective. So for Aquinas, as we've heard, this is just a kind of quick summary. The jus, or what is due to another, the object of justice, depends first on the overarching order of the cosmos laid out according to God's wisdom. It's therefore intelligible to our minds, and it is directed someplace, directed back to God ultimately. And it's composed of persons endowed with reason and free choice who are members of various communities. And these communities are themselves arranged in a hierarchical order. You start off in a family, and then you've got a neighborhood, and then you've got the state, and then you get, or the city, the state, the nation, the whole cosmos, the UN, you know, and then the whole cosmos, maybe. So Aquinas understands everyone to, you come into existence in an ordering like that. You don't join one of those things voluntarily. You are just born into it. And you find yourself in a network of relationships. Okay. Then, second, the jus, that is what is due, it is a function of the relationality, the network of relationships that follows from the place that individuals have in that order. So you're born into a family, you have certain obligations to your parents in justice. That's due them. You owe your parents a kind of reverence and what the older tradition calls piety. You obey them, you honor them, you try to do good things for them. Why? Because they're the source of your very being. And you can never repay them enough because you got your very existence from them. So Aquinas says you should always be grateful to your parents. The parents in the room, you know, feel free to quote me on this. Now this order that you're born into, it's not an abstraction. It's the concrete, particular, historical order in which I find myself. So you come into the world as the child of parents, living in a human community as a creature under God. So you didn't create or generate this order. You inevitably exist in a network of interlocking relationships, a part belonging to various different wholes, family, clan, city, etc. And these relationships have built into them something that is due. So there are, in fact, already a kind of rights built into the very network of relationships that we're born into. So this is very different from, for example, some Enlightenment thinkers or post-Enlightenment thinkers. John Rawls, if you've ever read John Rawls, very popular, more contemporary philosopher from Harvard. That ought to be enough to tell you that there's something wrong there. That's a joke. If anybody from Harvard is listening to recording, I don't really think that, but... well, I do kind of think that. Okay, so these modern or post-Enlightenment theories postulate that, you know, you begin as a kind of primitive individual and you choose to join a particular order. But that, factually speaking, at least for us, that doesn't happen. That tends to abstract from the concrete, real world that we live in. But Aquinas is very practical. He says, this is the world we live in, guys. So we should look at the relationships that you have. and what is due in virtue of those relationships. So the ultimate end of the human being for Aquinas is not a matter of our choice, not even for God. The whole plan of divine providence originates in God's wisdom as an ordination of reason with respect to the good. So we're born into the world as creatures who naturally occupy a place in that order and who are naturally ordered to a final end, a good that we don't choose. And our relationships are not a matter of choice either. You're just in certain relationships to your parents, to your brothers and sisters, to your neighbors. Justice thus has to do with our right ordering to the good that we don't determine for ourselves. It's based on a reality outside of us. That is, the relationships that we exist in. So, for a Thomist, then, when we talk about rights, we're not talking about properties of individuals as kind of monads. Does that word mean anything to you? Like an atom. Like, it's not atomistic understanding of individuals that are all kind of just aggregated together and bouncing off each other with their absolute claims to rights. Aquinas doesn't think of rights in that way. Rights are actually properties of relationships. Nor do we find the source of rights in an abstract definition of human nature, but rather by considering the human being as a rational and free creature ordered to God and to the common good of the hierarchy of communities that a person belongs to. Okay, so I think we've talked enough about how rights are related to justice. It's the due thing. But let's talk for a moment about the common good, because this is very important, and we're kind of coming to the end here. This is a very important element of understanding the purpose of politics. So law, now this isn't just Aquinas. I'm just going to assert this, and I'm ready to defend it. Law is teleological. That means law is always ordered to an end. And it's always ordered to a good, a common good, typically, either real or merely apparent. And rights are likewise, I would claim, teleological. They're always pointing towards something good. They affirm what is required of persons to be rightly ordered to each other and to the political authority in view of the common good. Okay, so for Aquinas, to respect the rights of another person, to give her what is her due, is not just a matter of a private transaction, but it means acting in right relationship to the order of the whole, to the common good. In fact, justice is a part of the common good. You want to live in a just society. You could even think of the Vanderbilt University community, and think about the common good of the university. If it was an unjust place, it would not be a good place to be a student. Justice is a part of the common good. And man's ends for Aquinas are not just arranged side by side, horizontally, you might say, but they're in a hierarchy. You can go up to higher goods, higher ends. So, you're ordered to individual goods, like the good of your own biological life. Chick-fil-A is very good for that. And then you're ordered to higher and nobler goods, like the good life you share in a virtuous family, or a flourishing and friendly neighborhood, or on a sports team that's winning, hopefully, or in a just city. And ultimately, you're ordered to God, who Aquinas says is the ultimate common good of the whole universe. That is, the whole universe is ordered to God as the good. And law of various types directs us to these various levels of good. And rights, then, can be understood as a function of a just ordering of each person towards the common good. So this is rather different from a contemporary theory of rights. On the Thomistic view, rights articulate claims of justice in relation to the end, and so they're not absolute or unlimited. They're in view of the common good. They always point to something further and nobler than an individual or a private private citizen. They point, in a way, to the common good of the whole, because they pertain to the justice of the community. Now, that doesn't mean that individual rights have to always bow before the political authority. To the contrary, some rights are a function of the order of the human being to a good that is prior to or more important than the political community. For example, your rights to worship God according to your conscience. Aquinas thinks that no king can tell you how to do that. You owe that to God. That's a higher authority than the king. But even these rights don't stand on their own. They stand in relation to a good. So this requires us to say a concluding word about the common good and trying to understand what that is, because I think when you understand the common good, you understand a little bit better what Aquinas is talking about and what is the purpose of our politics. From Aquinas' perspective, the common good is not something that competes with the good of individuals. And it's not like other private goods that are diminished when they're shared. More people invited to the party means less cake for each person, right? More people at this lecture means less Chick-fil-A. I'm using that. I've overused Chick-fil-A at this point. A common good is precisely the kind of good that can be shared by many without being diminished. Like, for example, the good of victory for a sports team, or the good of justice in a city, or the good of peace among states. To say, then, that rights stand in relation to a good is not to say that there's some kind of alien or hostile common good that trumps the good of the individual, or destroys it even. Rather, it's to see that the common good is a good for the individual. It's a good of a higher and nobler sort, in which the individual participates, and without which, and this is a key point, without which it's impossible to have a full measure of human happiness. Human beings are ordered not only to private goods like food and shelter, or chocolate cake, but also to common goods like justice, truth, friendship, peace. A winning sports team is nice to have in the mix. I'm a Seahawks fan, you know. Seattle goes crazy for the Seahawks. So it actually is a part of the common good of the city to have a kind of camaraderie, at least in that, you know. Our cities are often so fragmented. But in Seattle, if you're wearing a Seahawks jersey, like, everybody's your friend. And that's part of the common good. So the city exists, according to Aquinas, quoting Aristotle, not only that men might live, but that they might live well. So that individuals have rights which they can assert and which the positive law should recognize, that belongs not only to the private good of individuals, but to the common good of the community. In other words, the blessings of liberty, as the U.S. Constitution puts it in the preamble, that shouldn't be thought of describing a private good, the individual property of discrete individuals, but rather a dimension of the common good. And that's why we put it in the prologue of the Constitution. That's why we have a Constitution. It's not just to secure individual rights. Of course, that's a part of it, of course. But it's to secure the blessings of liberty for the whole people. And individual rights are a part of that picture. So it's a part of the common good that the community be just, that it recognize what is due to its members, and that it be composed of free citizens capable of directing their own lives by their own responsible choices. And that's what individual rights are for, according to Aquinas' view. So that individuals be secure in their liberties, that they possess rights, is an aspect of the common good. And the protection of those rights in law is a means for securing the common good. So what then to make, this is just the final point that I'll make and then I'll conclude. What then to make of the present situation where you have claims that are kind of absolute claims to rights and incompatible rights? I think from a Thomistic perspective, we would want to say rights of themselves are not simply absolute claims. They are claims with respect to something that pertains to the good of our society. And so we should, when we talk about them, when we get in debates over them, we should remember that in a way, this is a way of talking about what is really good for individuals and for the political community. And it's very important for our politics to not just have power fights over each other, over these absolute claims which we call rights. That turns politics just into inevitable clashes of political power and raw will. The purpose of politics is actually that we would have a reasoned deliberation together about what is good for our community. And then we order our life together, by law, to those goods, or to that good. And rights are a part of that picture. So what I'm trying to say is, rights are fundamentally important, but they aren't the whole story. They're a part of a bigger picture, and the real story here is about the ordering of the whole towards the good. When we understand rights as a feature of that, then we have a way of making sense of what our politics should really look like. Our political life becomes shrill when there are claims of incompatible rights. And I think, in fact, what's happening in those incompatible claims is that there is a deeper but camouflaged disagreement about what is really good. What is really good for the human person? Our political life can only improve if we're able to take away the camouflage and bring the disagreement about what is really good for the human person out into the open and talk about it. And that is what politics is for. Thank you. So I'm happy to take questions, objections, arguments, contrary. Yes?
First of all, thank you for the lecture. It's still digesting a lot of what you provided, as well as the Chick-fil-A. I was thinking that in our modern politics, I think part of the view we have now of rights is not only that the state make laws that reveal the prior political order that individuals are compelled to follow, but also that the law gives a little bit of space to people and doesn't micromanage in a sense. You can say, in order to secure the good order of society, we're going to mandate by law what children ought to render their parents. And I think this has been developed more recently by the idea of subsidiary, that the law only has limited scope, that the family has some prerogatives and findings and obligations and things like that. And is there a precedent in St. Thomas for the more recent Catholic notion, or recently articulated Catholic notion of subsidiary?
Yeah, so just so that everyone understands the question, which is an excellent question, subsidiarity is a label that's applied to what is a very straightforward idea, which is basically that decisions that can be made on the local level should be made on the local level. In the U.S. political system, we might call it federalism, or local control. It's the idea that you don't push a decision to a higher political level when it concerns really just the local community. And if a local community is functioning well, most of the decisions can be made there. That's, in a way, the more competent group to decide. Vanderbilt University as a community is better able to decide what's good for Vanderbilt than the whole city of Nashville. That's the basic idea. And only if there's a problem with Vanderbilt governing itself should you bump the question up to a higher level. So that's what subsidiarity means, and that's definitely deep in the Catholic understanding of political relations and law. So I don't think that's... Now, offhand, can I think of Aquinas, how Aquinas talks about this? He definitely thinks, for example, that that a family should govern itself, and the relations within a family really should only to prevent serious abuses ever be tampered with by the law. And there are certain things that he thinks that even just the individual is the only... So, for example, whether you have a vocation to the priesthood or religious life, Aquinas thinks your parents don't have a right to tell you what to do about that. You know that this is autobiographical for Aquinas? Because he was the son of a very high noble family. His father knew the emperor quite well and was, I don't know, maybe a cousin of the emperor or something like that. So Aquinas was a serious aristocrat from a seriously aristocratic family. And his family had big plans for him. He was supposed to become the abbot of Monte Cassino, the famous Benedictine abbey, not that far from Rome. And Aquinas didn't want to do that. So he was sent to study in Naples when he was 16, and he met the Dominicans, who were a brand new, very unreputable religious order. They'd only been around for, you know, some decades at that point. And he liked the Dominicans, and he decided to join them, which his family was horrified at, to the point that he entered in Naples, and they sent him north to, I think he was going to Cologne to do his novitiate, and his family found out about it, and they sent two of his brothers to kidnap him by force, and they held him in the family castle for 1 year to try and persuade him to give up on this idea of a Dominican vocation. And he refused. And so after a year, they finally agreed to let him go, and he joined the Dominicans. So he had a very personal experience of, like, what you owe to your parents and then what you don't owe to them. So that might be a good example of subsidiarity. But, Aquinas definitely thinks that, now the medieval political system was much more complex than we usually think about, especially in the 13th century when Aquinas is writing. It's not like the divine right of kings. That didn't really, that idea had not... really made it around at that point. So you had a very complex system of overlapping authority, of local authorities and cities, and so Aquinas thought all of that was, you know, had a proper place. He certainly, for example, doesn't think that the law should forbid everything that's wrong. Maybe that's another way to answer your question. So, is it wrong to lie to your mother? Yes. Should the law forbid it? No, because it would do more damage to have the law inquiring into those kinds of things. So it's a prudential question. What should the law forbid? It's a little bit different mentality than we have as Americans, because we tend to think if it's wrong, it ought to be illegal. And if it's illegal, we definitely think it's wrong. Or if the Supreme Court then makes it legal, then we think, well, then it must be right. And that was not Aquinas' view. Yes?
I very much enjoyed your presentation, and sorry, now that I have to ask the question, my mind is going blank. But I would say you've described politics, law, rights, something that every nation in the world is dealing with, even places like the UN. The church is kind of the one, you know, as a member of the church and kind of one who's pulling from her intellectual tradition, presenting it to us, sharing that with us. What does the church have to offer the political institutions in the world, or maybe what's the role of the church in relation to the political institutions of the world? Because as I just described, we're waiting for a bishop in Nashville, and I was just describing somebody, we don't have a democratic electoral process. We're more like a mixture of, like, a monarchy and the military or something. You know, it's like a totally different kind of system. So we're talking about politics and rights. What would be the relationship or the role of the church?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say the Dominican Order is sometimes claimed to be... Now, I'm just turning this into an advertisement for the Dominican Order. The Dominican Order is sometimes claimed to be one of the oldest democratic institutions. So we were founded in 1216. just over 800 years ago. And we do have a democratic form of self-governance in the Dominican Order. You get elected. We elect our own superiors for a 3-year term, you know, and then we have another election, so it's constant re-elections. And it's actually very interesting to talk about how we do that election, which in fact is very similar to the way a pope is elected. So if you have questions afterwards about how that process works, I'd be happy to. I find it very interesting. But what is the role of... So maybe to slightly change or contextualize your question, there was a big debate, or you might even say still is, among... in the church or in the hierarchy or among theologians about whether the church should use the language of rites. So the church did not always use the language of rites. And especially since some of the origins of the political movements, think of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was, of course, claiming the rights of man and had all this rhetoric about rights, universal natural rights, which they used to overthrow not only the monarchy in France, but also to attack the church. And it was very vicious. I mean, not just like taking the churches away, but cutting the heads off of all of the priests and religious. So if you've never seen the opera, The Dialogue of the Carmelites, or, you know, you can watch it. That's a famous opera where the Carmelites are being led in the final scene to the guillotine, and they're singing together, I think the Te Deum, and you get shunk, and one voice disappears from the chorus, and then shunk again. I mean, this is based on a historical event. They executed a group of like 16 nuns. I mean, political subversives. They were praying in their cloister. So in other words, in the name of rites, there were terrible things done. And the church was very wary of it for that reason. But by the mid-20th century, there was a real move and an argument made, especially by Jacques Maritain, who was himself a Thomist and drawing on that tradition that I referred to from the American colonies, like the Spanish-American colonies, claiming that we need to appropriate this language of rights because this is basically how modern political discourse works, and we need to just translate it into our terms. So since that time, you've had more and more magisterial documents coming out that use that language. But there are some people, and I know some of them. Some of them are like your Rod Dreher Benedict Option types who say, this is a bad idea because you see where rights are leading us? You know, leading us into... kind of chaos, stuff that the church definitely doesn't want to get mixed up in. So that's a live debate. And I think, in fact, really it's sort of inevitable for us to use the language of rights. It's an aspect of justice. So I don't think we really have an option. It's just a question of how to understand rights and to understand them in the right context. Yes?
As the lawyer in the room, got a lot of questions. But it was a great talk. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. I will just give you one. One of the things that I have been kind of seeing and observing is, particularly in the American space, and I guess in the space of Catholics and evangelicals, particularly on the conservative right, is one distinction is the evangelical side tends to take the position of rights and the relation of man to government in the very Lockean, Rawlsian sense that you described of atomistic individual right. And what you've described here is particularly a Thomistic, and what I would argue is a more Catholic view in general is this position of rights as relational. And particularly only is in our community, as our understanding of as a whatever the community is. And it seems to me that tends to run along the lines of here we are 500 years after Luther, tends to mirror the breakdown of Catholicism and therefore Protestantism generally. I guess my question is along those lines is to the extent that that's this communal relational aspect of law and justice really goes that deeper than just the Enlightenment. Is that really a Catholic issue, or is that something that many maybe even Thomas is drawing other things before him. And to what extent is that, do you see that playing out today in the real world where you're dealing with politics or other, you know, international communities?
Yeah, now notice, I mean, I think it does absolutely go deeper than Aquinas. Aquinas is a kind of very great summarizer and synthesizer of material that came before him. So he's not as original as people sometimes think, but what's original about him is the way he's able to bring everything together and kind of concisely summarize it and show you how it all fits together. So in his account of justice, he's drawing from Aristotle. Aristotle is a major, major source. He wrote a commentary on Aristotle's Politics and also Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Those are two great works of Aristotle talking about exactly this issue. And then Cicero, the Roman legal tradition, and Aquinas was clearly very familiar with him and is quoting him and citing him throughout his treatment of these issues. So, and then he's bringing in Augustine. Now, Augustine has, like, the idea of the city of God and the city of man and, you know, how to deal, how to live as Christians in a decaying republic or a decaying empire. So I think, actually, Augustine is a very interesting book to read in our own time when people feel like maybe things are starting to, you know, not work so well. I mean, Christians have lived through things like this before, and they've had very sophisticated reflections on them about what is law and how to live in a legal regime that no longer reflects what real Christian values are. And so Aquinas was drawing on all of those things. And the last point that I'd make is that notice I didn't quote from the Bible here. I mean, in other words, I talked about God, but not based on some claim of divine revelation. These are philosophical claims that Aquinas makes about God, basically about the law of God proceeding from God's mind. Aquinas, I'm sure, can quote some scripture passages to validate that point. But he's really making a philosophical argument about the nature of God. And he thinks that there are certain things you can say about God from just pure reason alone. And so I think this is the kind of argument that we can have as Christians in the public square without appealing to divine revelation. In other words, just making reasonable arguments. Now, I think it's legitimate to make appeals to revelation, too. But I wasn't trying to do that in this talk.
Father, I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you for the talk. I think it's some really interesting questions that you're asking. So I guess this might be a point of clarification and maybe just like a misunderstanding of what you're talking about. But, so it seemed like you had like two different rights that you were talking about. Sort of going back to your question about like the communal rights that you have and being born into these different structures and family and the neighborhood and the city, you then have like a sort of duty that you have to those structures. And then as part of a pursuit of the common good, those structures then endow rights to the individuals that compose them. So then I guess my question is, at what point does, and this is sort of relevant to modern politics and a lot of modern political systems today, at what point does your duty to the structures that you've been born into sort of fall away if your structure is no longer like aiming towards a greater good that is compatible with the greatest good, I guess?
Yeah, okay, that's an excellent question. So let me just say one word, and it's a classic question and a big one. So in a way, you could have another talk that's just really on that theme. And you get a lot of disagreement. Maybe even we could have some serious disagreement among the people in this very room about how to think about that. Let me just make one point of clarification. I don't think you had a confusion about this in your question, but just as you were asking it, it just made me think, well, I should just say this one more time or say it in a slightly different way. When I was describing the Thomistic understanding of rights in this kind of communal context, maybe communal is not quite the right word for it. It's the context of a larger order. In other words, rights are just a feature of justice because we're talking about what is due. It's the object of justice for Aquinas. The ius is the object of justice, and that's really what we're talking about just from the perspective of the person who can make a claim based on the ius. That's my right. So the rights are a feature of the just relations, and we're always going to be in relations. So you can't escape it. You know, unless you find a desert island where you're able to live absolutely by yourself, you're going to be in relations. And even there, you're going to have some relation to God, at least. So those relations are just a part of reality. It's not just a kind of community-based thing. All right, so if that's the case, contrast that with a contemporary understanding of rights. Their rights are such absolute claims that it seems like they are kind of destructive of the order. It's irrespective of the order. I have this right, and I will break the order with it if I need to. That's not Aquinas' view. But at the same time, he does think that rights can have a kind of absolute character. What do I mean by that? You can have a right over against the king or over against the government insofar as the government is instituted to respect the order that it exists in. It's not the government that creates the order. The government is a feature of the order. So when you assert a right over against the king, you are functioning as a part of that order. And it's okay for you to have some you know, hard rights to knock back against the king's authority with, because that's part of the characteristic of the order. My point is not that rights have to become mushy and therefore like almost meaningless. My point is that you have to situate rights in the context of the overarching order and the relations that justice is regulating. And then you understand what the rights are for and what they really mean. Because if you start to use rights to break the order, then you are being unjust. And that is a self-contradiction of the idea of a right. A right is not a right to be unjust. A right is a feature of justice. Okay, so now to your question. When you're talking about, what happens if this order becomes, or this government, or this political system that I'm in, becomes so corrupt or unjust that I need to fight back about it? Does it happen when, I'm cheated out of, 5 cents? No, obviously that's too small. But as you magnify the injustice, then you magnify the cause that a member of the order might have for, refusing to acknowledge the order, like a law. So Aquinas actually has an analysis of this. What do you do when a law is unjust? Do you have to obey it? And under what conditions? And he generally thinks that an unjust law of itself is parasitic on law. It is, in fact, not a law. Because a law is an ordination of reason for the common good. So a law that is a supposed law that is not an ordination of reason for the common good, in fact, has no moral bindingness on you. See, so Aquinas does not have this idea that because the law has been promulgated, you have some kind of duty of obedience. No. The moral weight of your obedience to the law comes from the fact that you respect the order. However, rebelling against the legitimate king causes a lot of disorder. So that's where Aquinas says, okay, that law is unjust. You, in a certain sense, don't have a duty to obey it. But you shouldn't rebel against it's a much graver threat to the order of the whole if you kill the king. So you don't generally kill the king. You see what I'm saying? You have to be able to say the order is so bad, the disorder is so bad by the injustice that it's better now to act against the duly constituted authority. He tends to think more like you would just disobey the law or something like that. There's a very interesting question, though, that comes up in Aquinas and in a lot of other scholastics. So this was debated and different people took different positions. What if you are unjustly condemned to death, but legitimately by a legitimate legal process. So you know you're innocent, but you can't prove it, and somebody lied, perjured himself or whatever, and put you in jail. Now you're awaiting your execution tomorrow morning. And then you notice the door to your cell is open. Can you escape? You're violating the law. Aquinas says, yeah, you can get out of there. So, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.